Chapter 57. Poland, January 1943. This is the place that makes her understand that hers is to be a sentence of death, as certain as any more traditional mode of execution. It will merely be a slower perishing, strung out in this wasteland. She will be buried in this frozen black earth. There are women of all nationalities here, it seems, including German. Some of them are, like Alice, political prisoners. There are other varieties of criminal here too. In Alice's quarters, there are two murderers, one prostitute and a thief. It is best to avoid drawing attention to yourself. It is important, too, to keep hold of your possessions, meager as they are, never to let your shoes or toothbrush stray from your sight, however broken and useless they may appear. Alice's shoes might once have been a pair of clogs. Now only the soles remain, and a piece of rough cloth has been nailed to each to keep them in place. Still, she sleeps with them clasped to her chest, because to be without shoes here is to invite a slow rotting of the flesh through frostbite and gangrene. This place operates according to its own set of rules, or rather according to its own particular variety of chaos. Some of the seemingly healthiest women, though all things are relative, are the first to succumb to the cold, to the lack of food, to the one of the many epidemics. While there are those who look as if they should no longer be able to stand or speak, and yet they manage by some miracle to survive the long hours required of them in the freezing fields. They are housed in a barracks of cramped, dingy bungalows. "More like piggots in a field," says the prostitute, whose name is Berta, "than a place where human beings might be expected to sleep." Berta is small and fierce, with a filthy turn of phrase. The other French women are wary of her brash manner, but Alice discovers that she rather likes it. To retain your fierceness here is no mean feat, a clinging to life. And there is something about Berta, the brilliant dark eyes, perhaps, the quick-witted turn of phrase, that reminds Alice of Georgette. She thinks of Georgette often, and Etienne. She hopes that they have managed to stay together. Being with the person you love must make it easier to bear it all. The dirt and cold, the many greater and lesser indignities, must make it easier, in fact, to keep a hold of your humanity. Alice thinks of Tom, too. She finds that if she focuses on the details, the scent of his skin, the hard warm plane of his chest beneath her cheek, his irises blue as the Corsican water, those long, clever artist's fingers, she can invoke him more effectively than if she tries to conjure him complete, all at once. There isn't time to invoke him when she crawls into her bunk, because she is always so exhausted that sleep crashes over her in a black wave, instantaneously, never mind the hunger. But she thinks of him when she stands in the frozen field at the morning lineup. Every morning, several women fall where they stand, never to rise again. When she feels the cold beginning to permeate to her core, Alice draws up her memory of those days on sun-warmed beaches, the feel of Tom's skin against hers. "You must have someone," Berta whispers to her early one morning when they sit facing each other on the bunk, having been shocked awake by the roar of Allied bombers above. "To conjure." Alice understands. "Who's yours?"
"My little girl, Thais."
"Where is she?" For the first time, Alice sees Berta unsure of herself.
"I don't know. I told her to go straight to the nearest church if there was trouble."
"I'm sure she would have done it," Alice says, for reassurance. Then, because she has been wondering, "Why are you here?"
Berta gives a humorless smile. "A man came to see me. He asked me to do something that I don't do, so I told him it wasn't on the menu. Then he tried to make me do it, so I bit him here."
She taps her cheekbone. "There was a lot of blood," she adds, with unmistakable relish.
"It turned out he was SS and Oberfuhrer, and the next day they came to pick me up. I never had a chance to check on Thais, because they came for me at work."
Her eyes are black in the low light, unblinking. "I'm sure she will be all right," Alice tells her, as confidently as she can.
She tries a smile, but the muscles of her face seem to have forgotten the expression. Especially if she's like her mother. Alice and Berta work side by side. Their task is to clear the land of the rocks and stones that pervade the poor soil, preparing it for future propagation. The idea that anything might be expected to grow here is ludicrous. As Berta says, they must be getting desperate. They work with broken spades and shovels, wheelbarrows with no wheels. Every day, another handful of women will survive the torturous roll call, only to be ground out several hours later in the frozen earth. Apparently, it could be worse. There are rumors of processing plants where the fumes cause slow blindness, of munitions factories and salt mines where the chemicals eat into the skin and weather it away in layers, leaving weeping sores that refuse to heal. Perhaps it is preferable to die in the air, in nature, beneath this endless sky. Or perhaps it is all the same in the end. They are ordered to work in complete silence, and contraventions are punishable by a day cleaning the latrines or the floor of the infirmary, which, even more surely than anything else here, equals death. Yet they have become skilled at the art of communicating without detection. It is worth the risk. Alice does not know how she would survive the day without conversation. When the nearest guard to them has made his progress along the line to the furthest point away from them that he can get, Bertha whispers, "Who's yours?"
"What do you mean?"
"You know, like Thais is mine."
"Oh,"
Alice suddenly isn't sure that she wants to say. She feels irrationally that to mention his name aloud in this stinging air might taint those memories of him that are so precious. But she must. Berta, after all, has offered up her daughter.
"His name is Tom."
"Your lover? I know that he can't be your husband."
"Why?"
"Because of the way you say his name. I've never met a woman yet who speaks of her husband with such a tremor in her voice."
"All right. Yes, he was. And my friend."
They fall silent as the uniformed figure makes his way back down the line. Later, Berta revisits the subject.
"Tell me about him then, your Tom."
"It's complicated."
Berta nods.
"I can understand complicated."
She gives an odd smile. "I wasn't always a whore, you know." Alice looks at her, deciding. Berta will understand, she realizes. She is aware, too, that this may be her only chance to tell anyone.
"I don't think I'd ever loved anyone before him," she says. "I mean any sort of love. My father and my brother, perhaps, but they died when I was a child. I know, if I get out of this place, that Tom's the person I want to spend my life with."
"So what was the problem?"
"There was a child."
"Ah,"
Berta says, knowingly.
"He didn't want you to have it."
"No, nothing like that. He didn't know that it was his."
Berta seems unconvinced. Alice can almost read her thoughts. There's not knowing, and then there's choosing not to know. She is quick to explain.
"I told him it was someone else's."
"Even though you were almost sure it was his?"
"Even though I knew it had to be his. He was the only one."
"Why? You were scared of how he would react?"
"Yes, I suppose so. Though not in the way you might think. If I told him the truth, he would have given up everything, all his hopes and ambitions, in order to provide for us. I could never have forgiven myself."
"Sounds like a saint."
"Not a saint, no. Just a very good man. Then the baby died, so there was even less reason to tell him, or so I thought. But having that secret from him, it has made it difficult to imagine a future for us."
"You have to tell him, you know,"
Berta says.
"Can't go keeping things like that from the person you love."
"I know. I will," thinks Alice. "If I survive this, I will tell him. Then, we'll start anew."